Welcome to Photo Geek Weekly, episode 29, recorded on June 9th, 2018. I'm joined today with a man who I have the utmost respect for. He does not consider himself a geek, but you look at the stuff that he's done in the past, from extreme macro photography to 3D photography, and all the stuff that I consider really geeky in my heart. This is a guy that is too humble for his own good, but a master at photography. In fact, he's been called many times the grandfather of digital photography.
Actually, the godfather.
The godfather. Okay, sure. Well, I'm looking at that gray hair of yours, Rick, qualify for both these days.
You're right.
Rick Salmon is the guest today in the co-pilot seat on the wonderful journey that we have down the geeky areas of photography, covering some news. And actually today I wanted to kind of dig into Rick's brain on some of the projects that he has going on as well. Rick, how you doing?
Well, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for being on the show. I have to get up to Canada and hang out with you sometime.
You know what? We have award-winning gardens right here, and around us we have within an hour's drive spectacular waterfalls and beautiful vistas. So if you ever get up here, by all means, I will show you around, and we'll have some fun.
And you have polar bears.
Yeah, they're a little further north, but
in Churchill, I photographed those guys. They were amazing, right? But this was about 15 years ago. Now the snow and the ice is melting, as you know, due to global warming, and the population of polar bears is going down.
Well, and the problem with that too is the polar bears, of course, they're starving in many cases because their natural habitat is being so greatly disrupted, and then they're going into some of the more northern towns looking for food, and you have to deal with that in a very unfortunate way. So their populations are so disrupted. They're still there. In some areas, they're still thriving. But the areas for which they can thrive is diminished.
Also, when I was photographing the polar bears, they're against, this beautiful snow and ice. And now I know people go up there and the polar bears are walking, around dirt, right?
Exactly. It's not quite as picturesque.
And speaking of global warming, I was in Antarctica 2 years ago on New Year's Eve. Antarctica, New Year's Eve. I'm in a T-shirt. It's so warm because the hole in the ozone down at the bottom of the planet is getting bigger. And again, just like the polar bears are starving and dying, the penguins are dying. And it's sad. It's sad. I know you love nature. You're an amazing nature photographer. And your love for nature comes through in your pictures. So I feel the same way.
And I remember hearing a story about the penguins. Basically, there was only one or two chicks that successfully hatched in one of the larger colonies down there because of lack of food.
Right.
And it's really sad to see that the next generation of penguins gets smaller and smaller based on the available resources. And this is a really big problem that us as photographers, hey, we could make it a mission of ours to continue to document. While we live in a fairly temperate zone, you're Croton-on-Hudson in New York, and I'm in Barrie, Ontario. We're pretty good here in this area. Yeah, if our temperatures fluctuate a little bit, if it gets a little bit warmer or a little bit cooler here and there, everything around us still lives. But that's not true if you go near the equator, if you go to India or some of the desolate desert areas where a couple of degrees difference will completely destroy the ecology, or into the Arctic regions where they are, again, very, very sensitive. So, again, we're lucky, but the world is definitely not.
Well, my son says, don't buy a place in Florida because the ice is melting. It's going to be underwater. But just get one more thing about the penguins. I know this is a tech show and your listeners want to get to all the tech stuff, but I was in the Falkland Islands also, and they have a special penguin there called the rockhopper penguin. And these penguins are dying because of overfishing. They only eat a certain type of squid. So they're dying. So the whole planet is a mess.
It is. And you talk about all the plastic in the ocean and how a lot of places are trying to ban everything from plastic straws to single-use plastics and what have you. And yes, it's steps in the right direction, thankfully. In Ontario here, we've got a lot of renewable energy that drives our electricity costs through the roof. but steps in the right direction. And then you look at China and they're opening up more coal-fired power plants left, right, and center. So, okay, one step forward, five steps back. But it's the world that we live in. So, hopefully we can get through this. I remember Stephen Hawking saying something at, I think it was like, if humankind could get past the next 200 years, we're safe. But the next 200 years are ripe with so many environmental or war potential for destruction that we could so easily destroy this entire planet, or the planet will still be here, just life on it wouldn't be. And so if we can get that 2 centuries out, then we're safe.
Okay, I'm hoping, my friend.
Let's hope. I mean, that's it's not in our lifetime. But anyhow, Rick, I always got to ask, too. I mean, we talked about where you've been in the past. What are you up to right now these days?
Well, I'm home in June and July. When I'm home, I'm on vacation. I really feel that way. I can cut the lawn. I can trim the bushes. I can play a lot more music. I play guitar. Do you play anything?
I don't. I've got a guitar that I inherited from my dad, and my daughter, who's 2 years old, loves to just strum the strings, just arbitrarily making noise. And then I'm holding that guitar in my hand, thinking that I kind of owe it to my dad to learn how to play it at one point.
You should. It's so much fun. Actually, on my website, ricksalmon.com, on the top left, the first thing, you know, I have my galleries, my workshops, everything. I have Rick's Music Room, and I actually have online acoustic guitar lessons and a piano lesson. And actually, from all the videos I've done, right, photography, HDR, whatever, my piano one has the most views.
I can play chopsticks on the piano, and that's about it. But again, I really should learn to do more, and I should check that out. That should maybe that'll be the push, Rick.
Okay, so we did that, and my wife and I have a new book out on Route 66, which is kind of fun. My son said to me, why does the world need another book on Route 66? Because there's a lot of books out there on Route 66. I said, we're going to do it a little different. So it's about photography. I'm shooting with my Canon digital SLRs. And so I have tips in there for a digital SLR shooting. It's a mirrorless. And my wife, she wrote half the book. She used the iPhone, so she has some amazing pictures. She knows every app on the planet. So we had a fun. So it's about, you know, how to shoot, where to stay, and it's really how to maximize your, like, an 8-day trip on Route 66, the best part of Route 66, which is in Arizona, New Mexico.
Right. And now Route 66 is an evolving thing, right? I mean, it used to be the main way across the country, and it was a pilgrimage for a lot of people to travel that way. And now that history is disappearing. A lot of places are being abandoned or being modernized so that classic feel is being hidden or obscured. And I'm sure your book touches on that too, right?
Well, you're exactly right. There is no more official Route 66. When they built 40 across US 40, Interstate 40, it killed Route 66, almost like the first day. People started abandoning the gas stations and the hotels and the shops and all that stuff. But so you're driving along Route 66 and you see these signs, these brown signs, historic Route 66. You go to these towns like Gallup and Holbrook, and it's just so cool. You're going back in time. Because the people who live in these towns want to keep that feeling of the 50s and the 60s alive. And it's so cool just to meet the people and to take the photographs too.
Well, exactly. And for me, to understand that history and to try to document it, as a photographer, because photography is not reality. You know, we see the world differently than our cameras see the world, and our memory is even different than the way that we see, right? If you see like a beautiful sunset and then you try to remember it a day later, your right. memory is different than what you saw, and your camera captures something different than what you remember. Everything is entirely different. So to try and bridge the gap between photography and memory, that's quite the feat.
Well, Don, it's funny that you say that, because I gave a presentation once and I'm showing my HDR pictures and I'm showing some black and white pictures and some fisheye pictures and some telephoto pictures. And the person said, you know, he's more interested in photo manipulation than he is in photography, and it's setting a bad precedence for the club, right? But so I did this post. I said, if you're a purist, don't do black and white. Don't use a telephoto lens. Don't use a macro lens. You know, don't do HDR. Don't do all this stuff that, you know, we can do, because what you say is true. What we see, even use a 50-millimeter lens or a 35-millimeter lens, that's not reality, because you're cropping out what's around it.
Exactly. And, you know, I had somebody, I was waiting in line to get a spot at my local City Hall's Rotunda. You can book it for a gallery. Anybody can go in and do that. And so there's a specific day you've got to go in. You're waiting in line with a bunch of other people. And so the lady behind me says, you know, is there a word or some sort of a phrase that I could say that I haven't edited my photos in any way? I want them to be, I want people to know that they are true to reality. And I cock my head a little bit and I look at her and I'm like, you're totally missing the point, because you know, if you want to be perfectly to reality, then again, like you said, don't use a telephoto lens. Don't ever use a macro lens. Don't ever consider a fisheye lens, because all of these bend reality. Human vision, I think, is something around 42 millimeters, but we see it in panorama because we have two eyes. So even a 42 millimeter lens is not going to replicate the world that we see with our own eyes. The of camera course. Is a fundamentally different thing, right?
Of course. It's a fun discussion, though.
Well, it is. And, you know, it is a relatively slow news week. So I'm glad that we can kind of opine on these different ideas here. If we were to dig into the news, actually, before we do, your book on Route 66, where can people get that?
On Amazon.com. Actually, on Amazon, I was just looking. It's available on Amazon.com in China and Japan and Germany, everywhere. Amazon's amazing. But it's still in English. So it's going to be translated pretty soon. But yeah, it's called How to Travel, Shoot, and Photograph Like a Pro by Rick Ensign. Susan Salmon.
Perfect. I'm going to have to get a copy of that. And I got to get my wife more involved in the photographic journeys that we go on, because she's always alongside when we're traveling. And she's a pretty decent writer as well. So.
Well, it makes it fun. I mean, we're a good team. And we've been married 43 years, and we never had a fight.
Wow. I think you're one of the very few people in the world that could ever say that.
Well, we've had a fight, but we have been married 43 years.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a good team, but, you know, that could be a whole nother podcast working with your spouse. You know, Moose Peterson here, my friend, does that. Scott Kelby and Calibra do that. It's interesting. It's the best, I think, you know.
I agree. All right, so I want to get into some of the news here. Again, there's not a whole lot to talk about this week. Canon has announced their new 70-200 lineup, a new version of their f2.8L image stabilized and their f4L image stabilized lenses, which is really interesting here. Because the f2.8 lens was a little bit older. I think it came out in 2010, so it's about 8 years old. The newer version is almost identical. They kept the same optical formula. I guess it was a winning formula. They kept the same image stabilization technology, although I have to give so much credit to Canon here. They are labeling it now as a 3.5 stop image stabilization unit. They previously marketed that same stabilizer as a four stop. And they looked back on all of their marketing and their ideas, and they said, you know what, this is really a 3.5 stop stabilizer. Let's label it as such, and let's bring that to the forefront. Let's be accurate about everything. And when a manufacturer does not overinflate statistics like that, I give them so much more credit. They did add new optical coatings to the lens elements and everything to improve it. It's not something that you would run out and buy if you already have the existing version of the lens, though. And I don't, honestly, Rick, I know you're in the same boat as me. I don't own a 70-200. I don't think I'll ever own a 70-200. I don't shoot weddings. Well, I don't own either of them, to be
honest.
Well,
I have the older 70-200 F4. So I got a pre-production model of the new 70-200 F4. And there's two things about this that I love. One is you could shoot at, well, before I say that, you know, the basic rule for hand-holding a lens, this is without image stabilization or vibration reduction, is you don't use a shutter speed slower than the focal length of the lens. Otherwise, you may get a blurry shot. So without image stabilization, 200 millimeters, don't use a shutter speed slower than a 200th of a second. With image stabilization, you usually be able to go down one or two, maybe three stops. So with this lens, we live by the Croton Dam, which is the largest. If you ever come here, I'll take you. This is we do workshops there. This is the largest handmade structure in the world. So handmade stone structure in the world. So the water comes over. It's so beautiful. So I got a pre-production model. I go over there. 200 millimeters at an eighth of a second, handheld. 200 millimeters at an eighth of a second. So this, these extra steps of image stabilization were amazing. I'm going to be doing a blog post on this. I'll send you a link when
The F4, they really improved the image stabilization. That's where the bigger improvements were on that particular lens.
Well, go ahead.
And I was going to say that, especially if you're doing something like waterfalls, you need that slow shutter speed to blur the water and give that really pristine, flowy, almost hair or lace-like effect, instead of it being very tumultuous and chaotic.
Right.
And to do that handheld before an image stabilizer like you're currently using, it wouldn't have been possible.
Plus, I sold my 70-200 2.8, okay, because I do most of my work – actually, all my work is outside. So do I want a lens that's smaller, lighter, cheaper, and more compact than the 2.8? Yeah, I want the F4. So I had the F4. So I'm testing this new lens, but there's something else really cool about it. Your macro photography has a lot of depth of field because you use focus stacking. If you're not using focus stacking, you get with an 85 millimeter lens, for example, you get very shallow depth of field, which is beautiful for portraits. You could take a portrait of someone with a 85 f2 or 1.4 and focus on the eyes, and maybe the eyes and the nose will be in focus, but starting at the ear, that will go out of focus. So you have very shallow depth of field. With the older f4, you couldn't get that close. Now, I have a picture of an owl. There's a local a wildlife center here. They were nice enough to take the owl out of the cage. For me, it was an injured owl that got hit by a car, so it can't fly. So they're taking care of it over there. And I was within probably, I forget how, maybe a foot and a half or 2 feet away. So I got the eyes and the beak in focus, and right behind the eyes, it's starting to go out of focus. So the eyes really stand out, you know, in portrait photography, in your and photography. I don't know if you feel the same way, but I feel if the eye's not in focus and well lit, you missed a shot.
Exactly. And in macro photography, you can be a fraction of a millimeter off and the eyes are out of focus, right? And so it's so difficult to get exactly the shot that you're after. I typically tell people that, you know, just shoot rapid fire while you physically move the camera forward and backward ever so slightly.
Right.
Because a lot of those shots are going to be near misses. This is bad advice in the film era, of course, because you chew through a roll of film for a single shot. But in the digital era, I mean, you can throw away 100 photographs to get that one that has just, because you're hedging your bets on focus. And, you know, it's great to see that they've increased the minimum focusing distance on this lens as well. Gives it more uses. I don't think that I'll ever really own one, though, because I always think of this lens as being a portrait lens, and I don't do a whole lot of portraiture. Like you said, you could use it for wildlife, you could use it for waterfalls, and it's got a lot of uses. I consider this to be the quintessential wedding lens, though. A wedding photographer would love to have this in their kit, and almost every wedding photographer that I've ever seen has some version of a 70-200 lens, almost always mounted on a camera if they've got two bodies, because it's got that perfect field of view for the wedding scene. Now, Rick, I've second shot weddings enough to realize that I never, ever want to have to deal with bridezilla myself. Have you ever shot weddings before? What's your take on that?
My wife and I got married in 1975. In 1976, I did my one and only wedding. This is in film, and I'm photographing the bride. And the bride, I'm using in a house, right? I bring a speed light and an umbrella. And I have a beautiful picture of the model. What I was really interested in is getting the good exposure of the bride and capturing the detail in a dress that she might have spent, you know, back then, I don't know, $1,000, $2,000 for, right? So the bride looked great. So the mother looks at the pictures, and there was a green curtain behind it. Now, this is film, right? And the mother says, our curtains aren't that color. They're a darker green. So she did. But you're right, bridezilla. Weddings are... that's a special breed of people, and I, a photographer, and I have a lot of respect. Some of my good friends are wedding photographers, and they do very, very well, but they're not for me. They're definitely not for me. Well, A, I don't like getting dressed up. I went to Catholic school, and my mother made me wear wool pants in June, which it is now, so I hate getting dressed up, so wearing the tux or a suit is definitely not for me.
I hear you. I've had to do that far too many times in my life as well. I've taken to when I'm doing camera club presentations or whatever, just jeans and a t-shirt, just come as you are and express yourself naturally. And for me, I like a good portrait image. I can enjoy the beauty and the aesthetics for that. But I don't ever want to really be making them outside of taking pictures of my family and friends. And none of those are really terribly staged. We get a get together, just everybody jump into the frame, take a couple of snapshots, everybody's smiling, and that's good enough for me for the most part. But when you see the length at which these wedding photographers will go to specifically stage photographs, it's an art form. It is a thing of beauty, and they've got the right tools for that. My tools are more macro lenses and fisheye lenses and things that break reality, where they are trying to make a version much better than reality as a memory for these people. So more tools for them, I guess, as we've got for it. But all right. Next story. This is one that I didn't even know existed, and I'm assuming that you wouldn't have either. There's a company out there that modifies Canon and Nikon, and I think Sony cameras as well, for astrophotography. And I know, I've known in the past that astrophotographers use very specific cooled camera sensors because a cooled sensor has far less noise on it than a hot sensor. And so this company has basically built a thermoelectric device into a camera. So they pull the sensor forward and put a Peltier device that gets cold on one side, hot on the other, and then the hot side, they've got this whole heat sink thing that dissipates the heat to create a very cool camera sensor with a huge modification to the camera. You should take a look at these, anybody listening to the notes on photogeekweekly.com. And the difference is quite stark. The amount of noise, the speckled color noise, like when you see hot pixels that are just stuck on white, stuck on red or green or blue, and it's just that color, those pretty much disappear whatsoever with this. And for an astrophotographer that wants to make sure that it's a star and not an error in the sensor, this is huge. For me, I don't really care so much because if I'm shooting the stars and there's some noise in there, well, then I've got more stars. It's for the beauty of the night sky and not necessarily for the accuracy of it. But what I was most shocked about is this very heavily modified camera doesn't cost a whole lot more than the regular version. For example, the 5D Mark IV, which is a reasonably priced camera, just over $3,000 right now. I think there's a rebate on it for about $3,100. The modified version is $4,750. So you're adding an extra $1,500 onto the price of the camera for this modification. I'm actually surprised it's that inexpensive to dive into this. And if you are an astrophotographer, you know, Canon has famously made a version of their 20D and a version of their 60D in the past that had a modified low-pass filter to have a band of light called the hydrogen alpha band, which is just in the very, very deep reds, more accessible for astrophotographers. So I know Canon has been aware that, you know, people have specific needs for this. I don't think any major manufacturer would go through a heavy modification like this, but I'm thrilled that some third party has come up with this as a solution because, yeah, there is a subset of photographers out there that that have very specific demands and will absolutely pay for it. Rick, I know you would never own a camera like this, but could you see something like this being useful if you were really pushing limits?
Well, you specialize, I think, one of your areas of specializing is this close-up photography. So I think I know people, my friend Mike Ince, aka Spike, who listens to the podcast, he loves doing the night photography. You know, he'll go out at 3 o'clock in the morning, get the Milky Way. So I think for someone like him, this would be great. But speaking of photo geeks, do you know about Breakthrough Photography filters? Do you use these?
Oh, I love them. They're fantastic.
Well, they have a new night sky filter.
Oh, do they?
They just came out. It's called the Night Sky Filter. It's $149, and it eliminates. It says eliminates light pollution. Now, my guess is it can't totally eliminate it, right? Probably just like a noise. You can't eliminate noise totally in a picture, right? You could reduce the noise because the noise helps make up the picture. But they have this just called the Night Sky Filter, and they have it in different filter diameters, and it eliminates, they say, my guess is greatly reduces non-destructively to your image light pollution, which is very, very cool.
Well, Rick, and coming into this blind, having no idea exactly what their technology is, my initial assumption is that their filter is blocking sodium vapor, which is a very specific frequency of light. It's an awful yellow color that a lot of streetlights are sodium vapor lights. And that's what gives street like night photography on a street that really orangey yellowy glow. But it is such a narrow band of light, such a narrow frequency that if you're ever trying to shoot in that light, colors pretty much vanish because it doesn't emit a full spectrum of light, so that can't reflect back off of a subject. And so if you remove that narrow band of light from the image, you're leaving everything else, which is pretty non-destructive, but that's where the predominant light pollution would be.
Your listeners can't see me smiling, but I'm smiling because you mentioned the orange color. You are dead on, right, because on their website, they have a before and after picture. The before has the orange, and the after has it looks more blue or more black. So here's what they say. Artificial light pollution ranges between 570 and 610 nanometers. You know what that means, right? Maybe some listeners don't.
That's sodium vapor. That's
right.
Exactly that.
Right, on the visible light spectrum. Artificial light pollution can reduce straight definition by up to 50%. And I'm almost done here. The orange color cast decreases contrast. This is important, right? So your picture is going to have more contrast. Decreases contrast between the stars and the space behind them, making an otherwise black black backdrop of a space look orange.
I'm going to have to get this. Thank you so much for bringing this to my attention, Rick, because there are many ways for you to improve your photography today that didn't exist two, three, 5 years ago. Now, this filter will be less effective in certain areas that have been replacing those sodium vapor lights with LED lights. And so we've got along our waterfront, they've got some classic lighting fixtures that still have these. So it would be very useful there. But a lot of the rest of our city and some of the cities around have been converting to brighter LED lights. And this won't filter out all of the light pollution from there. And that's why they say probably, 50% of the light pollution can be removed for that. But great to see that there's an innovation there. And there's a need for it, sure.
Also on Breakthrough Photography on their website, they have a free download copy of Night Sky Photography. So this is cool. I'll send you the link to that.
Everything's
on the Breakthrough Photography website. Yeah, they're great filters, right?
And not only filters, I've used their step-up adapters because they're beautifully machined brass and they've got that ridged edge to them. If you've ever gotten a filter stuck to a step-up ring or something like that, I mean, you're beating yourself up to try, like you're almost smacking it against the wall to try and get these things to disconnect from each other. And I've never had an issue with their step-up adapters. And yeah, I'll pay the premium to never have that frustration again.
Okay, speaking of filters and the geeks out there who really want to know all the latest and greatest tech stuff, Breakthrough Photography also just came out with magnetic filters. So you have a ring that you screw onto your lens, then you have magnetic filters without filter threads that just attract to the filter holder by the magnet. And the polarizing filter, actually, you could there's in the filter holder on the lens, you could dial in the polarizing effect on the polarizing filter. So at night, do you want to use a magnifying filter? I mean, do you want to use a magnetic filter or do you want to use a screw-on filter in the cold, right?
Rick, you're making me spend money.
That's okay.
I as soon as you mentioned that, I now have to, because I'm doing some projects on infrared and ultraviolet and doing some books on them. And that involves me putting the a different series of filters in front of the camera to take the same shot with a 590 nanometer, a 665, 720, 850, 1000 nanometer, an ultraviolet filter. And then I'm constantly unscrewing the filters and you don't want to change the composition. You don't want to touch anything on the camera and you invariably do. And you've got to, backtrack. And if it was all magnetic, then I don't have that problem whatsoever anymore.
It's cool.
So that alone, I will go and buy as soon as we end this call. So
okay.
Thank you for that. You say you're not a geek, and yet you have all of these wonderful tidbits of knowledge and ingenuity. So thanks for the contribution there. I'm going to jump into – I think this is going to be a fun conversation. It's going to be the last one that we have based on the news. It's twofold. Kodak is bringing back Ektachrome, and they were showing some of the new images, and they're not bad from Ektachrome. But Ektachrome is Ektachrome as it's always been. And at the same time, Canon has announced that their flagship film camera, the EOS 1V, has now been discontinued. And they're still going to be servicing it, I think they say, until about 2025. So it's a long way out if you do have one of those and you're actively using it. Leica recently announced that the M7, one of their film cameras, is out of production as well. I think they might still have one, the MP, that's still there. But film from the larger manufacturers, like from Canon and Nikon, it's really not a viable thing, and it hasn't been for pretty much a decade for them. But you see a lot of film companies. Kodak is still in the film business. Ilford, of course, is as well. Ferrania, Berger, Silbera, a lot of smaller companies are making film these days. Lomography in the film world has become more and more popular. And even the Fuji Instax, the instant film stuff, it's a huge surge of popularity within that. I know, Rick, you shot for decades on film, and I don't think you would ever go back to it, would you?
I would never go back, and you're too young to know what the BLH rule is, I bet.
I have no idea. What is it?
The BLH. B as in boy, BLH. When we used to shoot slide film, Kodachrome or Ektachrome, we had to use the BLH rule, and it was bracket like hell. Because right. You'd never knew it, you just with slide film, with print film you could be off a couple of stops, right? Or several stops. With slide film, you had to be right on. So I'm looking at you, your face is brighter than the background, you have the brown couch behind you, you have your beautiful pictures on the wall. To get this picture with slide film, I'd have to use the BLH rule. So people today, they don't realize how lucky they are that the dynamic range of these cameras is incredible. It's incredible. Then we have HDR also. So
of
I would
course, if you were shooting with Ektachrome even today, as some people will be, as it's now going to be available in 35mm and 8mm format, if you take a look at the latitude that that has, if you don't get it right, your skies are gone, your shadows are gone. There's nothing there for you. If you get it perfect, then you're golden. But getting it perfect, you have no idea. Especially in a high contrast scenario.
That's why you have to use the BLH. You have to bracket like hell. The difference, by the way, so Ektachrome has the color in it, okay? And it has like a little blue cast. Professional photographers for National Geographic used to use Kodachrome 64. Now, could you imagine I going on an assignment with Kodachrome 64? Like I was in a Buddhist temple in Myanmar, I'm shooting an ISO 6400.
Right.
Anyway, a lot of people don't know the reason Kodachrome was so good and so stable, even when you go into a hot location, is because Kodachrome was black and white film.
It was the K19 process that added the color.
Right, they put the color in there.
Or K14, I can't remember exactly what that.
You know your stuff. But yeah, slide film, I would never go back. But I'm glad I shot slide film because right now, when I'm shooting, I always shoot with my histogram activated and my highlight alert activated because I want to expose for the highlight. So if I'm photographing you, again, your face is bright in the background, I'm going to expose for the highlights. So this is what I do. So people say, well, you know, you really should go to just judge it by the histogram, not the highlight alert. Because, as you know, Don, most of the information is over on the right. So what I'm doing is I'm pushing that histogram exposure-wise over to the right to the point where I may get a blinky or a spike and then move it back just a little bit. But for me, exposing for the highlights is where it's at.
Right. And I always try to make sure the highlights are there. Because if the highlights are gone, if they're completely clipped, then there's no recovering them whatsoever. But you want to have them right in that zone where they're almost there. You can bring them back. There's lots of information. But the shadows, you can always bring data up from the shadows. You bring up the noise floor, and there will be noise that comes up with those details as well. But I think you said famously in the past that a great photograph, if the first thing you notice about a photograph is noise, then the photo has pretty much zero merit whatsoever. It's a terrible photo, but a great photograph will survive noise, right?
Yeah, actually, it's my father's quote. And when we used to shoot film and it was grain, he would say, if a picture's so boring that you notice the grain, it's a boring picture. Because back then, I was shooting Tri-X, which is 400, and we pushed it to an amazing 800. Today, I was out in Bosque del Apache before sunrise photographing these birds, and I needed a fast shutter speed. I'm shooting at ISO 10,000.
Yeah, hey, it's amazing what you can do.
What do you use to reduce noise? What plugins? Do you use just Lightroom or Photoshop or what?
Lightroom and Photoshop do a pretty good job. In some of the extreme work that I've been doing lately, I've actually found a flaw in their noise reduction. In extreme bright magentas and fully saturated magenta blue colors, their noise reduction slider actually increases noise. And I have no idea why.
You should tell them.
I did, and it kind of fell on deaf ears. They never responded. But I've been using the On1 Photo RAW software in the last little while, and it's getting really good. I've got the pre-release of their 2018.5 software, and the noise reduction on that does not have that same flaw, and it's equally as good as Lightroom. And I have in the past played around with DxO has their prime noise reduction, which requires a RAW file and some heavy processing. But I don't want to redirect my entire raw workflow through them because the rest of their software doesn't function as intuitively for me compared to everything else. So On1 is right now where I'm kind of sitting for my favorite.
I use Topaz Denoise. And what I like about Topaz Denoise is that it lets you, they have a bunch of presets like all the plugins on the left. And over on the right, you can control the noise somewhat in the shadow areas and the highlight areas independently, and then bring back the detail in those areas independently. So that's why I like a Topaz Denoise. But speaking of DXO, you know, Nick is back with them. They just released this week the Nick software, the Nick collection by them.
At a price. Now, for the longest time, for people that aren't aware, Google made the Nick software collection completely free and then abandoned it, basically, because they bought Nick for their engineers and for their the underlying stuff. Now it's in DxO's hands, and it's come back with a price point. What was it, $69? But you can get it for the remainder of this month for a little cheaper than that.
I think it's $49 now, and it's going to be $69. But while we're speaking, I'm sending you an email. You have your email open?
I do.
Okay, it's a screenshot. It's a screenshot from DxO about the Nick collection, and I want to see if you notice anything about this.
All right, let me take a look.
It's interesting because they should have had an old guy like me talk to them about designing their ad. Because you look at this, you look at the colors in the ad. It should be coming through.
Yeah, I see it.
These are the Kodak colors, right?
Exactly, yeah.
These are almost exactly the Kodak colors. So I think it's pretty...
It's kind of funny because, you know, I mean, they're playing on a different brand there, not necessarily their own. And there's nothing wrong with the Kodak colors, but if Kodak really wanted to put a fuss about that, there's... And maybe we'll put a link to this picture in the show notes so people can see what we're talking about. It's got a yellow background with a reddish-orange font. And that is absolutely Kodak. I mean, that's definitively Kodak.
Well, color, you know, as a photographer and a painter would know this too, and any artist would know this. The first thing we notice about looking at a painting, a photograph, a sculpture, whatever, it's the color. So this is the first thing that we notice. Speaking about colors and being like copyrighted, I don't know if these colors are copyrighted, but you know that yellow border on National Geographic is copyrighted.
I think it's pretty hard to copyright a yellow rectangle, but it's so definitive that they've got that button down. So I would imagine that Kodak would have some similar style guide copyright or something to protect it anyhow.
Yeah, I see photographers, you know, having fun with the photo. They take a fun photo of a sunset or a cheetah or whatever in Africa, and they make a fake magazine cover and they put the yellow border around it. You know, this is copyrighted by National Geographic. And every once in a while, I see like a new company, you know, run by young kids. They don't know this.
Well, so two things I want to touch on here, Rick. Number one, before we get off of the film thing, when was the last time you shot film?
2000. In 2000, I went to Cuba for my first time, and I took the first Canon digital camera. And I came back. I sold everything.
Wow.
Yep.
It was that sharp of a transition for you.
Oh, absolutely. It was like magical, right?
Yeah. And you never looked back. That's introduced to photography. I was in the digital era for sure. And I've gone back to the film era just to explore it, to just kind of understand what it was, and shoot it very occasionally just for fun or nostalgia. Whenever I go on a photo walk, I know that I'm not going to take a meaningful picture. I'm there for the conversation with people around me. So I dig through my catalog of weird cameras that I have in a shelf behind me, and I find something archaic and interesting. I've done photo walks with a 4x5 camera across my back, just because I knew it would be a fun conversation starter. And that's about all it is for me these days. It's just fun, and it's never anything that will be beyond that. So when you see the film era just kind of disappearing, it's now just becoming a novelty, and power to it for that. I mean, I'm glad it can still maintain itself as that. If Kodak was the powerhouse that it was, I think they might have an issue with the Nick collection ad that you sent me.
You know, you can't believe that Kodak lost it, right?
Yeah, you know, it's
just amazing.
It's well, I mean, they didn't transition properly. It's unfortunate because they were the powerhouse in the early digital era. They made modifications to Canon and Nikon cameras with digital sensors. They had all of the CCD patents split between them and Casio, I believe.
Right.
They didn't make the transition, started selling off their patents to stay afloat, and look where they are today.
Getting back to film, you know, people ask me all the time, what book? You know, I've written a lot of books. You've written books. What book should I get to learn photography? And I recommend two books. And they're not my books.
What are they?
They're both Ansel Adams books. One is The Negative and one is The Print. Because he talks about values in there and contrast like we were talking about before. One is Ansel Adams, The Negative. Again, the other one is The Print. It's a set. And I learned so much from these books. So I recommend these to your listeners if you want to learn about photography.
I picked up an old book. I don't even remember what it was called. It was a darkroom book. I just picked it up for a dollar at a used bookstore. And you can easily walk into a used bookstore if they still have one around you and get some old film era books. They might even have these Ansel Adams books there. But one page, just flipping through, jumped out at me as something very interesting, inventive in photography that we don't have in the Photoshop and the digital processing era in the same way. There was a photo of a bunch of small ships in a harbor, and they wanted to have the one central ship stand out from all of the ships around it. And the technique was to take a sheet of acetate, that's the overhead projector transparency material, cut a hole in it, and hold that over the print and kind of move it around a little bit to have a softer edge while the image was being exposed onto the print, onto the paper. And I'm just thinking to myself, that's genius. So simple, right, but so inventive. And in the digital era of photography, we lose a lot of that inventiveness.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And one book that I want to recommend, too, is from Freeman Patterson, and it is Photography and the Art of Seeing. I've got an old version of that that, again, I found at a bookstore from the 1980s, I believe. So purely in the film era that he had actually personally signed. It was a great used bookstore find. And that I read cover to cover. The techniques are photographic in legacy. They don't transition with digital. They are at the core of photography. So there are newer versions of that book that I think he's put out, and it's still in print. So Photography and the Art of Seeing is another good recommendation there.
Yeah, he's one of my favorites. Actually, I use a saying of his, and I give him credit. And the saying is that the camera looks both ways. In picturing the subject, you're also picturing a part of yourself, meaning the mood, the feeling, the emotion that you project when you're photographing a person, that's going to be and your body language, that's going to be reflected in the person's body language and their face and their eyes and their gesture and everything. So when it comes to people photography, definitely the camera looks both ways.
That is so true. So true. Now, back to DxO for a minute here. When I was reading this article, and thank you for bringing this up, the one thing that I was a little bit I don't want to say upset about, but it was that they haven't changed anything. They've made it compatible with all the latest operating systems and the latest versions of Photoshop and everything else, but it is 100% unchanged beyond the compatibility upgrades. And so for me, that's a hard sell, where I still have the free version that is running fine as a Lightroom plugin. Why would I pay for an upgrade that has absolutely no advantage? So it is a bit of an uphill battle to say that they've relaunched it. And yes, they're probably going to get some money from this to start developing new features, but they're not there yet.
Well, the thing is, I'm looking at here, I have two MacBook Pros, right? And they're 2 and 3 years old. I have one as a backup because I speak around so much, you know, I definitely have to have a backup. Well, I haven't updated Lightroom or Photoshop or the operating system because I don't want to lose the next stuff, right? Now, you know, I see this is available, and I know there's a new MacBook Pro, right, with the new super, what is it, the USB-S, you know, the really small thing. I don't want to buy. I don't need another, you know, $2,000 or $3,000 laptop. So the reason to buy that is if you have, you know, a new Mac. Right now it does work, but who knows, 2 years from now, if you upgrade what you have and bring, oh, by the way, we could talk about this as something for the geek listeners. I teach a lot of workshops, and I recommend to the people get the latest version of whatever your operating system, and definitely get the latest version of Photoshop and Lightroom. Well, when you load Photoshop and Lightroom, if you don't click the right button, you're going to lose all your plugins.
Right.
So you have
because it'll reinstall over top and just wipe everything else out.
Right. So I could send you actually this link from Knowledge Transfer, which goes through the different steps, what buttons you have to press. But so many people download, you know, the new operating system. Oh, you know, Lightroom lost my plugins. Photoshop lost my plugins. Right.
And to set up, like I know that you do your own printing. I remember seeing in a photo of your office before, you've got a large format Canon image prograph printer. I'm not sure if you still have it, but Canon has a really good Photoshop print plugin, and that's what I use to do all of my printing. And to lose that and all of the settings that you so meticulously fine tune over a year or so. Is one of the most frustrating things you could imagine.
Yeah, you have to click the right button.
Exactly.
Yeah, you just don't want to go update. I'll send you the link to this.
I'd love to see that as well.
Sure.
Now we're winding down the episode here, Rick, and I think it's been a great conversation. But
good fun.
At the end of the conversation, I always ask, what's the next big thing for you? Like, I know you're on vacation right now, but when you spring back into acting, what is going to be keeping you active and passionate about upcoming projects?
Well, our Route 66 book is doing so well. My wife and I are going out in August to do a book on the Oregon coast, where we've been a few times. We do workshops out there. So we're doing a book on the Oregon coast, and I have another class on Kelby One. Are you on Kelby One?
I have been in the past, but I'm not currently, no. But well, I just saw an interview with Kelby and Frederick Van Johnson, mm-hmm. Which it was a great interview, and just kind of discussing how Kelby has transitioned and evolved over the past few years, especially since Adobe has gone into the Creative Cloud model. And it's made me want to absolutely go and revisit Kelby One.
Well, I have 14 classes on Kelby One. One on composition, one on travel photography, bird photography. On Yellowstone, we did this last year. It's called Uncovering the Magic of Yellowstone and Grand Tetons. So this class is very popular. These, you know, the national parks in the United States are very popular. So in October, we're going out to Utah, and we're going to Bryce Canyon, Arches National Park, Zion. So we're going to be doing a class, a Kelby One class, on uncovering the magic of Utah's national and state parks. And we're actually shooting this ourselves with the Canon 5D Mark IV. And we're going to do some on-location stuff there. And your listeners can't see it, but I have a studio here, and I'm going to shoot the basics of the class in my studio here. So I like to keep busy.
Yeah, well,
I'm
absolutely.
I'm on vacation now. I'm playing a lot of guitar. I think a couple of more guitars might be in my future. You can never have too many. You can never have too many guitars.
Like you can never have too many lenses or bits and pieces of photo gear. I've got a table in my studio that is just covered with all sorts of obscure bits and pieces of photographic. Some of it's useful, some of it's just niche and memorabilia. And I'm sure you can call the same truth in any art form. Yeah. If you're a painter, you could never have too many colors. You could never have too many brushes or blank canvases that you can work
on.
Well,
every guitar is different, you know, and you feel like a jazz guitar with the thick body is different than a Fender Stratocaster, which is good for rock and roll, and a Les Paul guitar, which has a solid body, like a Paul Reed Smith guitar. They hold the notes like Santana. This is why he uses these, because they hold the notes forever. But another thing I'm doing is going back to Antarctica with Abercrombie and Kent as a photo coach on the ship. The last time we went, I was the digital SLR and mirrorless coach, and my wife was the iPhone coach. And going to the bottom of the world, Don, is just amazing. You go to Ushuaia, the southernmost city on the planet, and then it's 3 days over the Drake's Passage to Antarctica, and you're there for like a week, and then you come back. So it is magical being at the bottom of the world, and I wish they didn't have internet on the ship because, you know, I have to check, right?
The only time in my adult life that I have been disconnected from the world is when I was in the Yukon, where there's no cell service, there's no internet connection of any kind. The only thing that we had was a satellite phone, which was for emergency uses only. And it's the only time also that I have had a sense of clarity and serenity in my mind where I was not distracted by what the next email coming in was or the responses for the photo that I just posted on social media. It was really truthfully beautiful. But I'll never disconnect myself if I have the ability to connect just like you. Hey, there's
an
internet connection.
It's hard. I know. It's very, very hard.
All right, Rick. Well, where can people find you, the workshops that you do, your podcast, and everything else, notably Rick Sammon?
Just ricksammon.com, S-A-M-M-O-N.
I'm curious, do you have S-A-M or S-A-L-M-O-N, Rick Sammon the Fish, registered as a domain name as well?
I should do that because people might search for me.
Search for the wrong domain.
You know, I should do that.
All right. Well, do that before this episode goes live so Okay. Nobody else sneaks that from you. So, Rick, no matter how you spell salmon.com, and you can find everything about Rick there. And for the show notes and everything that we've been talking about here at photogeekweekly.com, that's where you'll find this podcast and all of the previous episodes. And if you're looking for me personally, you can find all of my work at doncom.ca, doncom.ca. And that winds down another great episode of Photo Geek Weekly. So everybody should go and get out and shoot.